Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
All of a sudden, all the women and my ex got into a vehicle and just left. When they came back later that day, my ex pulled me aside and said, "We need to talk." And I thought this whole time it was because of something I had done. And he just broke down and was just like sobbing. And he could barely even get the words out. And he said, "I'm losing my family. I'm losing everything. I have to be gone by tonight. And all I can take is what I need to survive." And one of the phrases was, "You need to leave and go far away to repent and never come back." And he said, "And all the other wives have to come with me. You are the only one that can stay."
Oh my gosh.
It was a very traumatic and emotional day for everyone. Everyone was just wailing in tears because they had to leave their children. It gave predators open availability to these unprotected children.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. As always, if you're only listening and you want to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness, where you can like, subscribe, become a supporter and advocate for these survivors who are coming on and bravely sharing their stories. We also love seeing those comments from you guys. Remember, our guests do read them, and it's so amazing to see all of the words of encouragement that you do leave for them after these interviews have aired. So today's guest, I was really excited to connect with her. We have been talking a lot about fundamentalist Mormonism, specifically the FLDS with the Warren Jeffs sect. You've probably heard of him. He is now in prison. You may have seen the documentary Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey on Netflix, which dives into the FLDS specifically. Today we are hearing from someone for the first time who was actually a polygamous wife in the FLDS. She was the second wife out of five. She had a few children while she was in. We're going to hear all about how she started to deconstruct, realized she needed to get away from there, and how she was able to escape with her children. And she is thriving now. And I'm so excited to get into her story. Thank you so much for joining us, Cece Hendrickson.
Hi. This is going to be a good time. Like, I feel like there's so much that you and I can cover, and I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, it's going to be great because for those of you who don't know, I grew up in mainstream Mormonism. Cece was part of the fundamentalist sect, meaning she did things way better as a Mormon than I did because she followed the original prophets, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, until there was the split when the government said you can't practice polygamy anymore. And they said, "Watch us." And they created their own branch. Although some have said, no, we didn't branch off. We are the original church. Is that how you feel?
Yep. I mean, I don't now, but I did.
Yeah. Like, we're not a branch. The mainstream church is the branch, right?
Like, technically. Fundamentalist. Like, come on. What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. So this compound specifically, and it was a compound, I'm right in saying that, right? It's like actually kind of its own community. It's insulated.
So they actually had more than one, and some were like that, completely enclosed with gates. No one could come in or out. The community I grew up in and lived most of my life in was a little more open, I guess you could say. There were people, outsiders, that came in and out, but they were always like watched. They had people, you know, following them, making sure that they only did certain things. There was only like certain areas that they could go into and not interrupting like the community and what we had going on there. And people leaving, like coming and going, if you had to go into town for, let's say, a doctor's appointment or something, you could do those things, but it was very like controlled. How long are you going to be gone? A man has to go with you. So even though you could come and go for specific reasons, they had someone there watching everything you did and had to know like when you were going to be back and all of that. So
yeah. And I know that this is your reality, right? We talk about all the time where when you grow up in a situation like this in a high control group, you don't really realize how high control it is until you leave it. But as a kid, did you feel like you were restricted in any way? Did you feel like it was weird, someone always watching over you, or was it just your normal?
You know, even though it was my normal, I've always been kind of a wild spirit, I guess you could say. And I always just felt like, why do I have to ask about this? Or why do I need to let so-and-so know that I'm leaving town? I remember one time, this was after I had kids, and we'll get into like this part of my life. But when I went into town one time without telling the man that was like over me at this time in my life, I got into some serious trouble. I got a phone call from the bishop, like asking where I went, why I was gone. And I had taken my kids with me as well. And I got into like some big trouble for that as well.
Oh, wow.
Even though it was normal, there's still that part of you, if you are anything like I was, where you're just like, why, what's the, like, I'm not going to do anything that I shouldn't. Like, I just want to go into town by myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And it almost makes you, at least for me, and this is my experience growing up Mormon, which is nowhere near as strict as that, obviously. But when they keep telling you, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, it almost makes you wonder, like, why? What if I did do this? Like, yeah. You start thinking about it more instead of just not having it on your brain at all, just like the extreme purity culture. And I know for you guys, you were expected to have your first kiss on your wedding day, right?
Yeah.
So when they're like, you can't, you can't, you can't, it almost makes you want to do it more because you're like, well, why? What's going on? What's the big deal?
Yeah. Like, what's it going to hurt? Like,
so yeah. We talked about Warren Jeffs briefly in the intro, and a lot of people may not be familiar that the person who ran the church before that was nowhere near as strict. And I know that the switch happened. It was Rulon, and Rulon is the one who was in charge. He was the prophet. And then his son, Warren, is the one who took over when Rulon passed or when he was sick. And that happened when you were 12. So I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of an insight as to the drastic changes that happened during that time.
For sure. So when Rulon Jeffs was the prophet, there was rules, like pretty similar in like the ways of how you dress, how you would carry yourself as a FLDS member. And the beliefs were very similar to the Mormon church. But the things that changed were Warren Jeffs becomes the prophet. And then all of a sudden, instead of just wearing a dress, okay, you wear a dress. It was a dress with very specific collars, cuffs. It had to be a certain length. The women had to wear their hair styled a certain way. You had to go to bed at a certain time, be up at a certain time. The rules that they had went from almost reasonable, like you get it, like, okay, they want their members to wear clothing that's modest. Mm-hmm. It went from that to extreme, like you cannot be seen in your sleeping garments. You cannot go out of your bedroom that way. You have to be up at a certain time. There's only certain foods you can eat. Just so extreme that it was every moment of your day was planned out for you. And there was prayer circles every hour on the hour. You could not be late for those. There was a family member for us, how we did it. We had a certain family member was assigned to keep names. So at those prayer circles, she had a clipboard with all of our names listed out. If you were there, you got a check mark. If you weren't, obviously it was documented. And it was the same for class times in the morning and at night as well. Just very extreme control of your time, of the way that you did everything that you do in a day. So that was the biggest thing I feel like that changed.
And also what I've been told in the past is the recreational stuff. So you were forced to either smash or burn your TVs or toys, and you all of a sudden couldn't have anything to play with. What was that like as a 12-year-old?
When I was 12, I had already like moved past that point in my life. I was already taking on very large responsibilities, cooking for our family, taking care of children. I had already stepped into that motherhood role, even though I was a child. And so I didn't feel affected as much by that rule of getting rid of your toys and things. The only thing I can remember that may have affected me is I did have a couple of collectible dolls that were porcelain. And that was, you know, I remember shedding a few tears over that. I had them for a very, very long time. They were gifted to me by someone that I loved, and it was a big deal. I have to get rid of these. And I feel like that happened a lot throughout the cult, though, where you had something, a possession, and if they decided that you didn't need it anymore, you gave it up. And so that was kind of the beginning of that for me, where I was just like, I don't need it. Okay. It's not useful. It doesn't serve the Lord or the church or this purpose. So you don't need it.
So not only did they strip away your individuality, they stripped away anything that you held close to you.
Yep. And they did that a lot. And so that was another thing. When Warren Jeffs became the prophet, he also had everyone purge and go through their things. And anything that was extra, you could only have like a certain amount of pillows, blankets, toys, whatever. You had to turn it into the storehouse. No one ever kept sentimental items. Like, I don't have any of my first baby's like outfits or anything like that. Like none of that. I don't have any at this point.
Okay. So I hadn't even considered that at 12 years old, you were already doing wifely duties or motherly duties. So what was your family dynamic, so I can kind of get an idea of the size of family that you were in?
So my dad had, he took his second wife when I was 10 months old. So for a long time, it was just two. There was my mom. And then my dad's second wife is actually my mom's sister. So it was just the two of them.
Sister wives.
In every sense of the word. Sister wives.
Yeah.
And so we just grew up with two moms for a long time. And then when I was about 11, my dad took a third wife. And this kind of totally like disrupted our family dynamic. We had gotten along so well with just the two moms. They had their, you know, they both had their kids. We intermingled, and they were both just mom to us, you know. And then this third wife comes in, and it was a total disruption. It wasn't just like our two moms and the kids. It was this woman that I didn't even know how to like quite get along with. And I didn't ever actually get to a point where we saw eye to eye. We fought a lot. She was very different than my mom and her sister and wanted to control a lot of things. And for some reason, my dad, he was controlling, but he would let her control too.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, it was very interesting. So that kind of changed everything. And that was where our family dynamic went until I left and got married.
Okay. How many kids were there between the two moms at that point before she came in?
Shoot, I just don't even know. I don't know. I would have to ask them.
Okay.
Yeah, I've never even thought of that.
So if you were to guess like a number, like maybe 5 each, 6 each, 7 each, maybe 10 each?
No, it would be more like 6 or 7 each.
Okay. So that's a lot of kids in one house, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
Did you find that the other mom, because we already talked about your relationship with the third, but the other wife, did you find that she treated your mother's kids equally and kind?
For the most part, she did. She had a very complicated relationship with some of my brothers. I remember her being abusive to them. And that wasn't really something I had experienced from her. She was very kind to me. But for some reason, a lot of her anger and that she was experiencing was taking out on some of my brothers at times.
Oh, that's really hard. And I've heard mixed reviews about the polygamy thing as we've interviewed people who grew up in these dynamics. And some say that, you know, they were great. It was like actually having a second mom who loved me. And then I would say most of the time, it seems like they treat the other kids differently because of this whole interesting dynamic of, I don't know if it's jealousy or just being upset or not being able to express yourself. I mean, there's a myriad of different things, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I was just curious what that was like for you and if that affected your view on polygamy as a child, knowing that this was probably going to be your future.
It did in some ways. And mostly it changed when my dad did take that third wife. That's when my thoughts on it did change, because I watched my mom and my dad's relationship change at that point. They were high school sweethearts. They grew up together, went to school together, and got married at 19, super young, and were just like cute, a cute couple. And then when they did take in the second wife, because it was my mom's sister, obviously she loved her. And so I think it was easier for her to accept her. And so they got along okay. But then it's like when this third wife came in and had like so much control over certain things, and dad allowed her to do things that he had never allowed the other two to do. And it kind of created like this rift between my dad and my mom. And mm-hmm. I watched my mom, like her whole spirit, like kind of faded in some ways, where she just felt like she couldn't speak up. She couldn't be herself. And my dad just didn't like accept her fully the way that he had before. You know, here I was 12 years old. A 12-year-old is going to be able to pick that up from their mom and feel, yeah. I felt sorry for her. I did. There was times I'm like, I feel sorry for mom, you know, mm-hmm. and sorry.
No, it's okay.
It's always funny when like certain things come up about a certain part of your story that have never like come up before, or they have and you've just like kind of ignored it.
Yeah.
I'm very protective of my mom.
Yeah. And that's totally understandable. I've felt the same way about my mom. I'll do anything.
Yeah.
To make them feel better. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was really hard for you as a teenager watching her go through that. And we mentioned off camera that 12 is kind of the age where they start prepping you to become a wife. And so that's why I was curious if it changed your perspective on becoming a wife, knowing what your mom was going through. And clearly you have a great relationship with her and yeah. you're seeing her struggle. Mm-hmm. And so when they did start preparing you for polygamy, how did you feel about that?
It was more of like, I don't really have a choice. And I was starting to experience, this was right around the time, well, a little bit after that, 13, 14, I feel like is when it really started to hit me, when I was like, okay, this is my life. Is this really what I want? Or should I be a little rebel around this time? And I started to sneak out and do like meet up with boys in the community that I had like a little teenage crush on. And it was around that time where I really did start asking that question, like, should I just leave with one of these kids, like, and just go start my life? But I didn't want to miss my mom. That was the one thing that kept me there, was mom. I mm-hmm. wanted to stay there and have her in my life. Of course, going out and leaving with one of these boys would have meant I was on my own. I was then going from being, you know, a teenager in a community, a cult, to being what they call, you know this, an apostate mm-hmm. on the outside without any support at a very, very young age. And that scared me. Yeah. I watched other people go through that. And no, it's not everyone's story, but I watched many, many of them leave and then become like drug addicts or end up on the street with the wrong people. And I didn't want that. And that was a big fear. You know, if I leave, that could be what my life looks like. Go from a comfortable home, even though I don't exactly love it here with the dynamic that I was dealing with, but I would take that over going out and living on the street. And if that meant that I had to be married and given to someone that already had a wife, I took what made sense to me as to be the safest option.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And that's something that we also speak on, which is when people say, well, why don't you just leave if it was so bad? A lot of times it's children in these situations and they don't know any different. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to be in the world, especially in a community that is so isolated. And another thing with cults is they demonize the outside world and they tell you if you leave, you will become a drug addict. Just look at Stacy or whoever. And they make an example of them as if that's the rule. And the thing is, they set you up for failure on purpose. So they don't tell you about the world because they want you to fail so you do come back. So you really don't have an opportunity to have the options that you think that you have. You don't have the options you think you have because they tell you there are no options. And it's just, this is how it works. And stick around and you'll go to heaven or the right heaven or whatever. And they train you to believe that this is the only choice and it's the best choice. They train you to believe it's the best choice. And so you think, okay, if I leave, not only am I losing my entire community, my family, my friends, I'm losing my salvation. I'm losing my spot in the afterlife. And then I really won't see any of these people ever again. And the stakes are so high. So no matter how bad it gets, you don't know that you can get out of it. And sometimes you physically can't.
That's exactly how it is.
So at 13, 14, you're kind of being rebellious and doing your thing. Do you get caught? Do you get punished at all?
Yeah, I definitely got caught. So, and I don't even know exactly how my dad found out that I was sneaking out, meeting up with these boys, but he definitely did find out and he pulled me aside. And disappointing my dad was probably the next thing to me closest to death. You know, I felt horrible like seeing his disappointment. Like he definitely carried it on his face and he let you know that you were hurting him. And I felt horrible about that. But at the same time, he basically gave me a choice. He said, if you want to continue to do these things, then we're going to have to look at other options and you may have to go. They had like little communities for people like that, girls and boys who were struggling. Then they would send them to go work somewhere or just like kind of be isolated from everyone because they wanted to keep you on track on your, in your faith. And if you had these distractions where you had like a crush on a boy, they thought that if they just like removed you from the situation where that boy was, then you would just like get over it. Mm-hmm. And so he told me that was one of the options. And then the other one was to get over it, figure it out, and listen to what they called, I think it's called home economic tapes or something like that. I can't remember the name, but it's Warren Jeffs talking and he's like basically training you how to be a wife. And it's like cassette tapes, a whole set of them. I don't remember how many, but my dad said you need to listen to them completely all the way through twice. And then I want you to, you can't go anywhere by yourself anymore. You can't drive anywhere. You have to take someone with you. And there, he had like this set of rules that I had to abide by and basically become worthy and ready to be married. I was 15 at this time and I was married when I was 16. So there was a year there where I literally became the good girl. I was like, okay, whatever dad says, that's what I'm going to do. And I poured my whole heart and soul into becoming wife worthy.
At 15.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I'm just imagining myself at 15. My goodness, I was not wife worthy at 15. I mean, who is really? It's like you are learning who you are. You are pushing the bounds. You're figuring out what you like, what you don't like. As far as even just with boys or whoever you're attracted to, it's like, this is what I want. This is what I don't want. But if you have someone literally indoctrinating you in your ear, telling you how you should be, that must have been so difficult to just conform, especially when you did have this rebellious spirit.
Yep. And I did struggle with it throughout that year. I put on a very good girl front to get into the good graces of my dad, at the time, Warren Jeffs, and just trying to navigate my life that way. But I remember there were several times where I'm just like, can I just say, screw this and just like be done. I don't want to be the good girl anymore. And you know this, how heavy and like, I still struggle with it to this day. Sometimes I'll open up my Instagram to say something and I'm like, well, that's not. And then I'm like, but like I just, it's not.
You're censoring yourself.
It's not good girl enough. Yeah. Right. I'm literally like, that's not what a good girl would say. Like,
yes.
It's not even that I say those things, but still I'm like, I swear, in real life, I'm a very unfiltered, just kind of a weirdo. But it's like when I show up on Instagram, sometimes I'm like, but someone will take offense to that if I say it, or, you know, and so I do that sometimes because it was so like deeply ingrained. And then other times I'm like, okay, just stop. It's enough. Like, there's no one making me be good anymore. Like, just stop.
There's so many layers to it because I'm the same way, but even especially, and I'm jumping ahead, but when you leave, you do have people saying, oh, she's a slut, she's the bad girl. Like, I went to LA and Vegas and I was doing modeling in bikinis and like all of this sinful stuff. And people didn't just think it. They literally said, wow, she's led by Satan. And so you start to believe it, not that I'm led by Satan, but that you're not being good. And I just, oh, I hate it so much. The whole be a good girl, like keep sweet, right? That's the whole thing. And the whole reason it was called keep sweet, pray and obey is he's literally telling these young girls, keep sweet, talk quiet, don't laugh too loud, and just be seen and not heard. And it's so damaging. And it does ingrain itself into your brain unless you actively unwind it once you leave. And it's a hard process. It takes years.
Yeah. Yeah, it does, because here I am 10 years later, you know, and there's still all those times where I'm like, I really just want to say this. And then I'll stop myself from doing it. And then I'm like, but why?
Yeah.
Like, why? There's people saying way worse things to me about it. Like,
yeah, I've definitely gotten spicier over the years.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. And you start to just eventually be like, there's no reason for me or any of us to filter ourselves and try to continue to be this good girl, because in reality, you are a good person. So why continue to hold those standards over yourself because of what someone else told you? Or, you know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to come to get over it.
It's a lot. And then in the middle of this, in the middle of you trying to be the best good girl that you can at 15, you learn that you're about to be married. Can you talk us through what it's like in the FLDS when you are basically assigned a partner and how that made you feel?
They kind of changed everything too. It was around the 2 years before I got married, or I say married. I was never actually married, but a spiritual marriage, we'll just call it that.
Legally married.
Yeah, I was never legally married until now. But so in the FLDS cult, around the time I got married, this is how it went down. They called me up on the phone. It was my dad. He was on a mission at the time. He tells me, someone is going to pick you up at this time and you need to be ready to go. I look at the clock and that's like in 3 minutes. Whoa, wait, you know? And so I run upstairs and the only thing I could think of doing was brushing my teeth. So I brushed my teeth. Yeah, I was like, that was the only thing that came to my mind. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, a 16-year-old given 3 minutes to go meet who is potentially going to be the person that they have a future with. Like,
yeah,
that's just insane, you know? And so I hurried quickly, did that, walked downstairs, and there's my mom on the phone crying. And I just said bye to her. I couldn't tell her where I was going, anything. And I walk out the door and there's a vehicle sitting out in the parking lot waiting for me. So I get in it and we drive to another home. It's one of the leader's brother's homes. And I walk inside. They make me sit in a room and wait for however long. I don't remember. It felt like eternity. But I sat there for a while and then eventually someone came in and got me. And the whole time I'm sitting there, I'm just like so nervous, you know, not knowing who this person is. They hadn't told me anything other than I was getting married that day. That's all I knew. And so for 40 minutes or whatever it was in that room, I just was like going through my brain, like, who could it be?
Oh my gosh.
Thinking of all the men I had like come across at some point in the church. Would I be a first wife, second wife, 100? Like, I didn't know at all what my future after that moment would be like. It was a lot to try to like figure out what I was doing, where I was going, and how my future would be. And then when they did come get me, I walk in and there was who I would potentially marry. And we did like the FLDS ceremony the way they do it there. And that was at that time, it was just like you hold your hands together a certain way and they say some words and then send you on your way.
Just like that.
Yeah, just like that. And then you basically, that's your, you walk out that door and your life is forever changed at that point.
Did you have a wedding dress on standby?
No.
Or you just show up in whatever you're wearing?
I was just wearing, at the time it was a dark blue dress. I had a wedding dress, but they told me not to wear it. I think that's why they changed the marriages around that time, because Warren Jeffs was sought after by the law. And so the marriages had to happen in hiding. And if there was a bunch of girls running around in little white dresses, they would know exactly what was going on if anyone caught wind of it.
Right.
So it was a wedding in hiding. And that's why none of my parents were able to be there. Nothing. It was just me, a little 16-year-old on my own, trying to navigate this big life-changing experience.
That's a lot to take in. And I want to know how long you had that wedding dress on standby in your closet.
I can't even remember. And to be honest, I don't even know if it was completely finished. I feel like it was hanging in my closet, but there was like some details or something. I want to say a year. I want to say I had it for a year.
So at 14 or 15, you already had a wedding dress ready to go, even though you never used it.
Yeah, I never did use it.
Were you bummed that you didn't get to wear it?
In a way, a little, because I feel like it was definitely, this might sound funny, but I styled that wedding dress the way I wanted to dress there. Like it was still a dress and it was very beautiful, but it wasn't how you see most FLDS women dress. It didn't have the weird collars or anything like that. It had lace on it. It was really cute. For the time being, I felt like it was cuter than like something I would wear in an everyday setting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was a little bummed.
Yeah, I can just imagine, because I mean, I wasn't wifey ready at 15, but I definitely thought about my wedding dress.
Sure. Every girl does. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you have this whole idea of, oh, when I get married, it's going to be like this. I'm going to do my hair like this. It's just ridiculous, the amount of planning, at least for me. I don't know if everybody does that, but I was super pumped about a wedding at 15. I mean, I thought I was going to get married at 19. That's a whole different story, but that's like Mormon culture for you.
Yeah.
I didn't, but yeah, I can just imagine that you would be a little bit bummed. You don't know who you're marrying. It's not a big celebration. Did you have a celebration afterwards with family, or it was just, that's it, you're done?
No, that's it. Like him and I went on a trip for a few days shortly after, like within the first week. But other than that, it was very low key, next chapter kind of thing.
What's going through your mind when you see him for the first time? Like, what does he look like? Are you thinking, oh, that could work, or oh, this is the guy, or I don't know about this, or like, how old is he?
I think the only thing, honestly, that went through my brain in that moment was, I've seen him before. I've seen him before. And then I was like, and uh-huh. He has a wife and some kids. And in my brain, I was like, they're a cute family. Like them as a family was cute. I didn't think that me being a part of their family would be cute. Like I didn't think that far ahead. It was more of like, oh, I've seen them before and they have a really cute family. And that was about it. I didn't think about his appearance. I did not think much past like how, like that was it. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I'm nervous as hell. Like I was so nervous. Like I didn't know what to expect after that. So
yeah. How old was he?
He was 35.
Wow. That's a big age gap for a 15 or 16-year-old.
He was, almost twice my age.
At this point, I know from previous interviews that the sex education is basically non-existent. Like you can't know anything about your anatomy, how the whole reproductive system works, and then you are told to get married and have as many kids as possible. So at this point, had they kind of told you this is what's going to happen when you get married and this is what you're expected to do?
No, and I think that might have been part of the reason my mom was like really upset. She had done that with my older sister, given her like, she had time.
The rundown.
She had a whole 24 hours or more knowing my sister was going to get married. So I think she had time to like educate her and give her like an idea of what she was getting herself into. But we never had that conversation. It was literally just go get married. And I went and got married. And then that conversation was actually between me and the guy at that point. And it felt very, I was so scared, and I actually thought that we were doing something wrong and that he was wrong. Mm. I remember thinking, there's no way that this can possibly be right. Like, what he's telling me is absolutely not happening. I was so scared. When you're told your whole life, don't even look at boys, and now all of a sudden they're saying, get in bed with one and have children with one. It's like such a flip of a switch. And for a young girl to go through that and not know anything about what that actually is to have a child, like how you're going to get a child in you and all of the details that you just have no idea of.
Yeah.
It's very traumatizing. I'll just say that. Like, I was in tears. I remember I went in the bathroom after he like explained everything to me and I just cried. I was like, this isn't real. Humans don't do this. There's just no way, you know? Mm-hmm. And obviously I came to terms with it. There was a lot more conversations that were had between the first one and then, you know, as time goes on, but I was scared. And I think that it's really important that we have those conversations with our children at a very young age. They're smart enough to know. And I feel like it will be less traumatizing for them to like know what's going on with their body. And like, as it progresses, I mean, you know, when a girl goes through puberty, like talk to her about the changes that will happen as she's having them, instead of like, okay, you have periods now, boom, you go have sex with a guy. That's just so much for one person to like process on their own. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I really did struggle with that. So,
yeah, I mean, I can't imagine a ton of time had passed from when you hit puberty to when you got married. Did they explain what the menstrual cycle was about, or did they just say, you bleed now and this is what you do?
That's basically how it went. My mom was the one that explained it, but there was a lot of restrictions on moms too, as far as like what they could talk about with their kids about that, about babies, about your body, about your menstrual cycle, about any of that. That was very monitored. You know, my mom was very vague, I guess, about it. She only told me what I needed to know to take care of the very present things happening. Mm. But there was no like why my body was doing that. I had no idea the details of the reason for it. The only thing I knew is that you had to have periods if you wanted to have children.
Okay.
That was it.
So you knew they were related, but you didn't really know how or in what way. Mm-mm. Ugh, it drives me crazy, which is why we've done whole episodes on purity culture, because it is so damaging when you try and protect this vulnerable population from premarital sex. And I say protect like in air quotes. It really just creates a lot of issues unnecessarily and probably unintentionally, when you could just easily explain to them, these are your body parts, at a very young age, be like, this is a vulva. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it also protects them, because then if someone inappropriately touches them, they have the vocabulary to say, mom, someone touched me here.
Yeah.
And you can have those very open conversations. I'm not saying talk to your kids about sex when they're 3 or 4,
no,
but give them basic language for their own body and for boundaries, and let them know what's okay and what's not okay. I think that's totally fine and it's needed.
Yeah.
Because so much abuse happens in these societies where there's just so much restriction, and it's really, really dangerous and harmful for kids and even teenagers when they don't have words or language to understand what's going on if someone is hurting them.
I agree totally with you on that. And I feel like it's almost a way to keep those innocent and the younger people that don't know what's going on from speaking up and being able to talk about it.
Yeah.
If something is hurting them or happening to them, because they don't know what to even talk about. Like, what is actually happening to me? I don't know. I can't tell you, because there's no words to describe what it is.
Yeah.
And that is, I am so passionate about that, because I've seen like the damage that comes from especially cults and cultures where that purity idea and mindset is so strong that they completely just don't even talk to their kids about it at all. And then horrible things happen. No one knows what's going on. No, it's not talked about. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think in Keep Sweet, Pray, and Obey, they were talking about how the social workers couldn't even really get out of these young girls who were being assaulted by Warren at the time in like big ceremonies all together, calling them heavenly sessions, which makes me want to throw up. They didn't even know how to say what happened to them because they didn't have the words, and they're like showing them dolls. Can you point to this area? It's just, oh, it's so heartbreaking and heavy and hard to talk about, but it's something that needs to be talked about so that more awareness can be brought to these subjects. So I appreciate you being open and candid with me, because I know it's like a little uncomfy sometimes to talk about our sex lives. So at what point did you get pregnant then? Because you had your first child pretty young, right?
Mm-hmm. I got pregnant around 5 months after I was married. So,
oh wow,
I was 17. I had turned 17 between then, and I was still 17 when I had her.
And at that point, were you just, I can imagine, just straight on mom mode?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Immediately, just like, because also you were now a part of another family, and how many kids were already a part of the family previous?
She had five, and she was also a full-time working mom. She ran part of his business. And so at that point, I literally just took on mom mode. I was the mom that made most meals, picked up the kids from school. Even though they went to like homeschools or whatever, there was still that like exchange that had to happen. Yeah, so I became a mom immediately, even before I had my own child. So
that is so much to consider. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around what it would have been like for you at 16, 17. Not only are you joining a family where there's already another woman there, you don't know this guy, he's almost twice your age, you get pregnant immediately, and you have five kids to take care of. Was that just so overwhelming, or how did you handle that?
It was almost like expected of me. And so I never really considered my own feelings about it, to be honest.
Okay.
I think I just like took it on and I was the black sheep of the family, because here I was interrupting their family dynamic. And I totally understand that now. At the time, I didn't really understand it when I was there in it. I was like, why do they hate me? Why does everyone hate me? But now looking on it, I'm like, wow, as her, the first wife, now having to share her man and having this woman or this girl, I was not even a woman yet, taking care of her children and trying to navigate my own teenage things that I was experiencing so much. And I'm sure there was times where she just was like, you know what? I could just slap you. I know that she felt, you know, like I was probably in her eyes, just another child trying to take over. And, you know, her and I did not get along. I totally understand it now.
Yeah.
It was a lot. That part of it, I feel like there were times where I was like, can we just be friends, get along? We have to live together.
Yeah.
We had very, very different personalities, and we never really did get to that point.
Yeah. Were you able to grow to love this person? Not her, the guy you spiritually married.
In a way, I don't ever, like, my kids have asked me this, and I always just tell them I loved him, but I never was like in love with him. And
yeah,
a big part of that reason was to do with the fact that a lot of men from the FLDS aren't able to emotionally connect. They have, I'm not even sure why that reason is. It may be because there's so much on their plate all the time, trying to work and bring in thousands and thousands of dollars for the church, and just trying to remain a certain type of guy for the church, you know, raising a perfect family with no mistakes, all of these things. It's a lot of pressure. So there's not really any time to like connect emotionally with this person. And that's where love grows, is if you can connect with someone on an intellectual level, that's when you fall in love. And so there was never that in our relationship. So I loved him and appreciated him, of course, but there was no like, I love this guy to the moon or anything like that. And of course, when you're sharing someone, there's also that dynamic where you almost have this guard up all the time, because you know that they're not fully your person.
With you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because I wondered when these other three wives after you, right, came along, if you felt that jealousy of like, wait, no, this is my guy, or if you ever got to that point of feeling that affectionate love toward him.
I did get jealous. And I think I've talked about this before on other podcasts, but the jealousy I felt was less about going and having like intimate time with him as him paying attention and noticing me as I am as a person, mm-hmm. you know, being appreciative of me, my personality, my individuality, and just noticing. A guy from there is not really going to do those things because they want all their women kind of to be the same and to just do their, you know, put your head down, do your job. If I call on you to come spend intimate time with me, then I do. But that's not really where the jealousy came from. It was more of like, just being noticed and appreciated, actually mattering in this dynamic.
Yeah.
And so like, if I saw him noticing another woman or like giving her special attention, that's where the jealousy came in, where I'm like, I'm here too. Like, do I need to yell? Like what do I need to do? Like what can I do for you to like pay attention to me? Because I've been over here huge and pregnant for 3 months and you've literally not even like hugged me, you know, kind of that sort of jealousy. If you call it jealousy, sometimes I'm like, maybe it's just a pregnant woman needing a time and attention and love. I don't know.
I mean, pregnant or not, everyone wants that. Everyone wants to be seen mm-hmm. and noticed and recognized. And especially if you're going through pregnancy, that would just heighten everything.
Yeah.
And something that you just said really struck me, where you're like, if he calls on one of us to go be intimate. So it seems like, because you were saying it, you didn't really feel jealousy when it came to that, that there didn't seem to be any sort of love there. Is that kind of how you felt? It was more transactional. It's just like, okay, now it's time to try and get pregnant.
Yeah, I feel like that for the most part, because very little of that intimacy has to do with the woman.
Okay.
It's not about her feeling a certain way or feeling cared and loved for. It's more of just, I mean, it's taught right there in their culture and in their scripture, sex and those types of things were only to be done to have children.
So you can't even do it recreationally. You're not supposed to.
No, you're not supposed to.
That's a bummer.
It's not for pleasure, especially not for the woman.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it was very much a transaction. Yeah. Because only time you were doing that was to have a child.
How close were your kids in age?
They're all about 2 years, roughly.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
And I had four of them.
Four kids. So at this point, after your fourth child, were there five wives living in the home altogether?
Yep. By the time I had my fourth child, he had gotten married to three others.
What was that like? Just having five women in one kitchen?
You know, I really quite got along with most of them. For the most part. Like we kind of just became friends and tried to co-navigate this crazy life with tons of kids and all this responsibility, homeschooling, cooking, cleaning, keeping up with a big home and just all the things, you know. And you had the only way to really like survive, because that's really all you're doing is surviving, is to just make friends with the people that you live with, even if you don't totally like get along. At some point, you just have to be like, hey, we live here in this house together. We have kids that we're raising together. Like you kind of develop. I feel like there was probably more feelings of love towards a few of them.
You're kind of bonding together.
Yeah.
I've seen some comments in the past of some people saying, and I feel like they're guys saying this, they're like, women should be happy about sharing the home and someone to help them clean and cook. And I'm like, okay, from a dude's perspective, like I can imagine that some of that sure would be pros to the situation, but from your perspective, were there more pros or cons with living polygamy?
Well, people think, well, why wouldn't that be better to have multiple women in the home helping you cook, clean, raise your children? Think of this, with every woman that comes in the home, there's five or six more kids. So does it really help?
Right.
Does it really help? No, I don't think so. I don't. Like all it does is like brings more mouths to feed, more messes to clean up, more people. I'm just like, there's no pros here, guys. Like, come on.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, just because I kind of had an eye roll reaction to that comment and I was like, ugh, but obviously I haven't had that experience. So I wanted to find out from you what you actually thought. But it makes total sense. It's not five women taking care of one family.
No.
It's five women taking care of five families.
There's no pros to it. And that's exactly how it was with every woman that came. They had their own set of children. Like, they had children too. And it, the family just gets bigger and bigger. By the time our family was the size it was when I left, we had 20 something. I don't even remember the exact number. Children under one roof. And, you know, I have like 30 plus siblings myself at this point. So families are big there. And there's just nothing easy about providing and taking care of that many children. Nothing easy.
Yeah. And something that I wanted to ask you about from your other interviews that I've seen in the past is that there was this point where Warren just started sending people away. And are you comfortable talking about what happened with your family unit and how that panned out?
Sure. Yeah, I can talk about it. So Warren Jeffs did start sending people away for various reasons. And it was a very, what's the word? It happened very quickly where he was just like, hey, you go, you go, you go, you go. And it was like one family after another was being split up. And our family, the family I was a part of at the time, was one of the first to have that happen to them. And it was just like a random Tuesday. I don't know which day, but it was a random weekday. And all of a sudden, all the women and my ex got into a vehicle and just left. And I'm just like sitting there. Like, they didn't ever do that without being like, hey, we're running to the store or this or that. And I was actually scared shitless at this time because I thought maybe they were going to get blessings, like a church blessing of some kind. And I was being left behind. And I was mortified because I was like, maybe I didn't qualify or something's wrong with me. I did something wrong. So they get to go be a part of whatever they're doing with that. They can't tell me because it's a secret, obviously a church secret. So I felt like I had done something wrong. And it was like that all day where I was super stressed out, going over everything that had happened over the past few months, wondering like what I had done to create this situation where I wasn't involved in what they're doing.
Yeah.
But when they came back later that day, then my ex pulled me aside and said, we need to talk. And I was like, great. So it's really as bad as I had like ever imagined. And I thought this whole time it was because of something I had done. And he just broke down and was just like sobbing, a grown man, like sobbing. And he could barely even get the words out. And he said, I'm losing my family. I'm losing everything. I have to be gone by tonight. And all I can take is what I need to survive. And then he told me the exact words that were said to him. And one of the phrases was, you need to leave and go far away to repent and never come back. I was like, okay. And he said, and all the other wives have to come with me. He said, your name was named, but it was named as you are the only one that can stay. And I was like,
oh my gosh,
what is happening? So I, you know, that it was a very like traumatic and emotional day for everyone. Everyone was just wailing in tears. Everyone, because they had to leave their children.
They made them leave their children behind?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm trying to understand what the benefit of that is. Like, why would Warren want to do that and remove the women too?
I have my own ideas on this. And I still like, I believe this even to this day. If you remove influence, positive influence or protection from children, you can then
manipulate.
Yes, yes, you can manipulate them easier. You can make them into who you want. So if there's a protective parent, a mom or dad that's like, no, I don't think we should do that. That's not right. We're not doing that with my child. Then that stops them from being able to do whatever it is they were going to do. And with the FLDS, if you remove the parents, what do you have? A lot of children without that protection. And the leader can literally say, go do this, go do that, go do this, go live with this person. And horrible, horrible things happen and have happened because of that separation. And I haven't talked about this a lot, but I do know that after a lot of parents were removed, it left the children completely exposed, and it gave predators, which I believe Warren Jeffs and every single one of the men that were close to him are predators, open availability to these unprotected children. That's how I see it.
Oh my gosh, that's heartbreaking. And now, are you the one that's responsible for all these 20 plus kids in your house?
So two of the moms had arranged for their children to go live with their relatives. And so they were all situated by the end of that day before everyone left. But I was still left there with two of the other mom's kids for a short period of time. It wasn't long at all. And they were then placed with relatives as well. And then I went and moved back in with my dad's family.
Okay.
And they let someone else use the big house that we were in.
Wow. They just ripped everything right out from under you. Just pulled the rug right out.
Yep. And that they did it to so, so many families. Like that was not, even though we were one of the first, it happened over and over and over hundreds of times for weeks and weeks and weeks after that. It was just like this huge purge of people that left hundreds and thousands of children parentless.
Was this the first time that you started to consider you had an option to leave now that you were no longer a part of this family structure?
Yeah, it was right around that time where I was like, hey, the reasoning for them being kicked out did not make sense at all. And it raised a lot of questions of like, okay, so if they can just make this up about people, then they can literally make anything up. They can literally do anything they want to. And people will just do what they're told because that's what everyone does. And so at that point, I started to ask myself a lot of serious questions and slowly started to secretly date someone. And I knew it would probably get me disqualified to be there, which eventually it did. And I didn't want to get placed again with someone else. My biggest fear was like, hey, well, I sort of got along with the guy that I was with and his family. Like we made it work. But what if, here I am, you know, 25 years old, I got placed with someone that I did not get along with, maybe a 70 or 80 year old. And, you know, like just this whole, like, I don't know where they would place me if I was to get remarried here. And I don't want to see what that looks like.
Yeah, at this point, I'm sure you've got a little bit more grit having these kids and you're 25 and the rebellious spirit, I imagine, coming back out again, like, okay, I'm going to stand up for myself now. I don't want to be a part of this. It doesn't make me feel comfortable. How were you able to actually transition out of that house, out of that community?
So at first, I told my, well, I just one day was like, okay, I found an apartment. It was about an hour away from the community. Went and figured it out. I was totally just going to move into it. And my dad found out and stopped me. Was like, if you leave this town, you are an apostate and you have to like cut all ties with us, your family. And I was like, well, I didn't want to do that. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll stay, but I have to move out of your house. I can't continue to live in your home, because the way my dad saw it was I was still 16 in his brain and I hadn't had kids. So he would constantly get after me and be like, you need to honor and respect the mothers in the home. He would tell me that all the time. And I'm like, Dad, hello, I am a mother.
Yeah.
And I have children and I have to protect them. So I don't really care what your wife or wives say to me about my children. I'm going to do what I got to do because I'm their mom, even if I'm not married to you. Like, you got to switch your thinking here. I'm a mom too. And we kept having these like big fights back and forth where he would be like, no, if they said that your children need to do this, they're the mothers. Like, you need to respect that. And I'm like, no, 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 you got it wrong. Like, so that's where I was just like, I'm going to move out. Even if I don't move out of the community, I have to move somewhere else so that I can just focus on me and my four kids and just try to make it work. And I had become a non-member at this point. I don't know if you understand what that means. If you're a member, you're like accepted. You can go to church. You can take part in shopping from the storehouse and all of that. If you're a non-member, you don't get to go to church. You kind of lost your place in that scenario, this go to church, shopping from the storehouse. Now you are kind of on your own, even though you still live there. Mm. It's so weird and it's kind of complicated to try to explain it. But so as a non-member, I was like, I'm not shopping from the storehouse anymore anyway. I might as well just go live my life. Like there's nothing at this point keeping me here. And I was still dating this guy secretly too. So that comes out of the woodwork. Everyone finds out. I get in super big trouble. And then my dad's like, okay, you know what? Go ahead. You can move to that apartment an hour away, but you have to stay checked in. I'm going to be calling you every morning and night for class. The bishop's going to call you every single day. And so even though you don't live here, you're still like have to live your life a certain way. Mm. And I was like, okay, fine. You know what? That's fine. At least I'm not living here. So I move. And that's kind of where the shift started to happen. Like I made a couple of friends that were not in the FLDS and we talked and I was like, you know what? This is really messed up. All of it is completely messed up. So I became pregnant at that time and I didn't have support really from the guy that I had been seeing. So it was like he was all about me until I became pregnant. Oh. And then all of a sudden he was like, toodles, you're on your own. Sorry that happened. That was his mindset. And he at one point even told me, I never even asked for this. I never even wanted a baby. And I was like, but we talked about a baby like several times. Like it was a very obvious conversation that we'd dreamt about what our baby would look like.
Oh my God.
So I was like, what? Like, so you were just lying that whole time? Like, wow, I had no idea. And so I thought I would have support with my four children being pregnant and that even that fell out from underneath me. And the church obviously at that point was like, you're on your own. And they came, picked my kids up and I became homeless at that point.
Oh my gosh, Cece, they just came and took your children from you.
I called them and was like, I don't have the support. I have no idea what I'm doing. And here I was pregnant. So it was like, well, they were calling me every day too, checking on me, making sure I was doing everything just perfect. So it was kind of like this thing where I was like, I guess you're right. I'm wicked, evil, horrible person. And you're right. My kids need protected because I did not know that the depth or even close to what was really, really going on within the FLDS cult at this time. I was still very, very much protected from the truth about what they were doing, even on like the ranch and all of that with the younger girls. I did not find that out until after I had my baby and she was like a year old.
The arrest with Warren in Texas because of the CSA happened a few years before you found out.
Yeah, it happened quite a while before, like 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Before I found out.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, it's easy to keep people in the dark when they don't use the internet.
Right.
And so, and they literally told the people several times, if you look at anything on the internet, it could disqualify you from being a part of the community, being able to be used by the prophet is the term they would use a lot, which is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
Now to really know what that means. Is absolutely awful. But back then when you heard you can't be used by the prophet, it meant there was no life for you. Like there was nothing more.
Yeah. Extreme information control is a huge part of being in a cult when they restrict what you can and cannot look up or sure search, ponder and pray within our own resources. And if you get an answer that is different than the one that we're giving you, then it's wrong. Go back and try again. It's like, it's not really.
Yeah, so, so wrong. It's like, there's so much more information to what they are sharing with you, but they keep it very much under wraps so that you don't find out the actual truth. And I remember exactly where I was sitting and everything when I found out what had happened on that ranch and how much in danger my children were in, that I was like, no way, this can't be happening. I have to go get my kids. And I did what it took. I like worked so much, saved up every penny I had and went back for them.
Yeah. So how long were you apart from your kids?
A year and a half.
Because at this point, and I just want to make it very clear for everyone too, the mind control is still happening. Like you were technically kicked out and you knew that you didn't want to be there, but that's still your reality. That's still your baseline. You don't really know anything else. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you felt that the best thing that you could do as a mother to keep your children safe was to keep them in that community because you felt unprepared in this big, scary world that they've demonized your entire life. And so,
so true.
I can only imagine at that point when you're realizing my kids are in extreme danger, I can no longer let them be there. You know, one of the things we say is when we know better, we do better. And at that point, you knew better. And that's when you really did everything that you could to make a change. So what did that actually take to go in and extract them?
I'm going to start first with the fact that it took me months to really deconstruct what was happening. Like I remember laying in bed till 4 or 5 a.m. listening and watching videos and just researching every piece of information that I could possibly get my hands on and talking to other people who had been in those really, really messed up situations and had actually been hurt themselves. And they were like, girl, you got to go get your kids. This is horrible. Like, it's actually worse than you ever imagined. And I gaslit myself a lot where I'm like, it can't be that bad. Like, how can something I believed my whole life be so horrible? And eventually I was like, okay, I've talked to enough people who have been in the details of the horrible story that I don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And I moved. At this point, I lived in Colorado and I found an attorney here in Utah. And she advised me to move to Utah since my kids were also in Utah. And I relocated. That took a few months to do as well. You know, save up money, got to move and then get situated. You have to be living in the state for a certain amount of time as well before you can call it your, I don't remember residency? The word, but until you can call it. Yeah. You have to be living it like in Utah. I don't remember if it's like 3 months, 6 months or something, but you have to be living here to be like, okay, this is where I live. And so after I had lived here long enough and all of that, we got all the documents we needed. We went in to the community and tried to get my kids once the first time and failed. Couldn't find them. They weren't at the address that I had for them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know where they were. I actually was afraid that my dad had gotten wind that I was coming. I had tried to keep it as quiet as possible. But one of the things that they would do is if they heard a mom or dad was coming for their children, they would put them somewhere where you couldn't find them. They'd hide them. They would, you know, put them in hiding. And so I was afraid that's what he did with my kids. And that really scared me because I was like, well, where could they be at this point? They could be in Mexico or Canada or somewhere so far away that I can't touch them. You know, I can't get to them. And that added a lot of stress on to the whole situation. And then eventually my sister, who had left like shortly before I went in for my kids, told me she saw my kids somewhere in town. And I was like, oh my gosh, like find out where they live. So she did. And so we went in almost exactly a month later and was able to successfully get them. But at that time, I kind of thought my daughter might not be with my boys and for sure found out like, no, she hadn't been with them for almost a year. So it was just my three boys there with my parents and I was able to get them that day. And I had to like fight for my daughter in a completely different way. Found out she had been with my ex that whole time. And him and I had talked a few times over email throughout that year. And he never once like mentioned to me that he had her, which really, really broke my heart, because I could have been repairing my relationship with her throughout that time. And I had no idea that I could even have access to her or even any of it. And so I was really heartbroken over that and extremely upset at him for keeping it a secret when I should have known, you know. But eventually we worked it all out and decided between the two of us, it was better if the kids were all with one parent or the other. Like if they were visiting him, they all visit him. Mm-hmm. If they are going to live with me, they need to all like be living with me. And then, you know, just to keep them together. And that was my goal all along. And I told him that. I'm like, he did not support my decision to go get the boys at all. He was like, no, really? I will not support you in that. I think you're making a mistake. Yeah. And so I did that completely on my own. I didn't have like his support in that at all.
Was it because he was still very much trying to get back in the good graces and be let back in to the community?
Yeah. And I, you know, even to this day, I think that's still where he's at.
Okay.
Mentally. Yeah.
Does that concern you at all, knowing that with this joint custody, when your kids go to his home, does it worry you that he is teaching them certain things that are still part of the community?
It did for a long time. I was so like, please don't, you know, it was very clear to me. My attorney told me he can't control what I tell my kids and teach my kids, and I can't control him. And so I would just make it very clear to my children, and I still do this to this day, that they have a choice. They can choose if they want to believe what he's teaching them, and they can believe what I believe, or they can find their own way. Like they have choices in life now. They don't have to just do it because their parents do. And that's like helped them a lot. They're now, you know, older. They were much younger, 8, 10, 12. That was about their ages when I got them. Now my oldest daughter is 18. Mm. I have a 17-year-old. Like they're much older. And they think for themselves. And I asked them one day, I said, if your dad was ever like, I'm going back and I want you to come, what would you say? And they're like, we wouldn't go. Like, why would we go back to that? And so I feel like that they've experienced the freedom and like having a life, just living the way that they enjoy, that there's nothing that would pull them back into it.
Yeah. Oh, I bet that's such a huge relief.
For sure. For a long time, you know, I was like, the kids are so like, I don't even know what the word is.
Impressionable.
Yeah. The kids are so impressionable. I told you, I don't remember anything. The kids are so impressionable. And they will literally like just pick up on whatever everyone else is talking about and be like, okay, yeah, that sounds fine. We'll go do that, you know? And you tell them something enough times and they will believe it. That goes for anything.
Yeah.
It's like the little voice in their head. We talked about that earlier, being the good girl. Like any kid is going to pick up on those things and be like, well, that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. And so a big, big part of the healing that I have worked on with my kids is just making sure that each of them know that they have a voice, they have a brain and a mind and all that to think with and make choices for themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm like, even if you have questions or like you don't like something I'm saying or doing, like in a respectful way, you can tell me. Let's talk about it. You tell me what you're thinking about that. And please, like questions and open conversation are so welcomed.
Man, Cece, they got lucky that you're a great mom. You're doing all the things. I love it. Giving them options, giving them space to grow and be themselves. I mean, I can't imagine after living with you on the outside, they would be like, yeah, I do want to go wear prairie dresses and have bouffant hair. It just doesn't sound like something a kid would choose.
I don't think so. You know, they were very hesitant coming with me, though, in the beginning. Like, obviously, there had been like some stories told to my kids about like me and my choices. And so they were like, no, we don't want to come with you. Grandpa says that you're like bad. You don't have a testimony of the prophet anymore. And my son like pulled me down towards him and he was like, Grandpa said that you don't have a testimony. Is that true? And I said, that's not true. But the reason I said that was I do have a testimony. It's just not of what you think it is.
Right.
And later I had to explain that to him. I'm like, I have a testimony, my own.
That he's not the prophet.
My own. That he is not the prophet. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot to try to like explain to a kid in 5 minutes, hey, you need to come with me. It's actually really bad here. And I'm like trying to save you.
Right. Yeah, because they have no concept. Like we were talking about earlier, it's just their reality and that's all that they know. Mm. And so I'm sure now you probably have conversations where they're like, hey, mom, thanks for getting us out of there.
Yeah, there's so many. They have their own stories, too, where they remember things, you know, and they're like, that really sucked, you know, and I'm like, I know, like. It's a good thing that we're out now.
Yeah.
Things are not looking good. So.
Let's talk about your out now story, your consciousness side. I know you got remarried. You had another child together. Yep. You guys just look like the happiest family on your Instagram with your photos. I'm like, oh, they're so cute. How are you doing now?
We really are. Like, I mean, you know, meeting the man that I married, his name's Aaron. He's awesome. For the longest time, I was so afraid of even letting a man like get really close to us as a family. And part of that was like, there's just so much baggage there. And so it was hard to finally just let someone in and let them see everything. Just like, this is what it is. We came from a high controlled religious cult and my kids were left in it. I wasn't with them, like explaining all that to him. He handled it all with such grace. To this day, sometimes I'm like, I don't understand. Like, how did you just like, okay, well, I want to learn more about it. And he did a deep dive into like learning more about it. And I learned actually a lot while he was doing that.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. But it's also helped us like as a family just like grow and learn and heal together, you know, helping the kids like understand even what they went through. He's had those conversations with them as an outsider. It's really helped a lot because when you get so many people that experience the same thing, you don't really think of some of the things that someone who didn't grow up that way would think of. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally. That's my husband now.
Like, like even teenagers dating. Yeah, even like teenagers dating and stuff. Like he'll tell me stuff and I'm like, oh, my gosh, yes, we should talk to the kids about that. Like,
right.
I didn't know. I don't think about it, you know? Like, oh, yeah, you are right. But so we've definitely like, I guess in the last 5 years, just come a long way and figured out like how to parent together, and he never had kids before, so you know that's a lot.
Yeah,
just like all of a sudden you're a daddy of 5 kids who came out of a cult. it's just a lot of, well, 4 of them came out of a cult and then a baby, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like it's a lot, but we've come a long ways, and I feel like that we are just living life and making it work, you know.
Yeah. And you have a clothing line, Pink Valor, which is so awesome.
Pink Valor.
I would love for you to just tell people a little bit of how it's kind of morphed and changed over time.
Yeah. So when I very first started it, I was pregnant with my last baby. And I wanted to start a clothing line right after I left, because obviously we made our own clothes. Women from the FLDS, I just want to say this, are very, very talented. And they know how to do a lot of things, and like I would say like lost talents that people don't really pay attention to, like sewing your own clothes and braiding hair and things like that, you know? And so like being able to make literally anything that you can put on your body is actually a really cool thing to know how to do. So when I first left, I was like, I want to do that. I'm going to start a clothing line and I'm going to like make things. But eventually I was like, well, I'm just going to start with where I'm at. We'll just start with a cute little clothing boutique, and I'll just put things in there that I think are cute for like little girls and women. Things I wished I could have wear when I could have worn when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where it started. It was a very like, and it sort of still is like a feminine, very like girly brand. But then after I started telling my story at the first of this year, I changed even where I'm like, I felt a little less like soft and set back to like, what the heck? We're like out here telling stories that once were so, so hard to even talk about. And I just wanted like more and more women to understand what that actually feels like. It's so, you know, you talk about leaving and then you actually leave and start telling your story. It's so freeing. And that's kind of what Pink Valor became, was like this brand. I just like design t-shirts that have like messages and things that I want other women to look at and be like, oh my gosh, yes, I need that. I want to feel empowered when I wear that. And that's kind of where the brand has gone since then.
I love it. So awesome. I took a similar approach. I went to school for fashion design, and I remember my bishop mm-hmm. being like, it's so great that we're going to have some modest fashion designers. I'm all, huh? I don't want to design modest clothes. And so I left. I think I left maybe 3 years after that or 2 years after that. And it was just so fun. It, like you said, it's liberating to design anything and mm-hmm. make anything and just express yourself in that way. So I love that. Mm-hmm. Everyone go check it out at Pink Valor on Instagram. Support small businesses.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then we definitely want to shout out your Instagram, cc.hendrickson. You've got almost 100,000 followers over there. You're really doing a thing.
I started telling my story in January of this year. And at the time, I had 2,500 people.
Oh my gosh.
So all that growth has happened in the last 10 months.
That is insane.
It's a little intimidating sometimes. I'm like, whoa, like I talk to thousands of people
yeah. every day. Overwhelming, but that's
there
great.
There are times I'm like, I really have to like push myself to like keep showing up. Like this is a lot of people, but it is. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good because I actually, when I first started cheering, was a little scared too because I didn't think people would even get it or resonate or I just was like, no one's going to understand like what it's like growing up in a cult. This is so unheard of. And then I started sharing my story and I was like, whoa, wait a second. Actually, this is crazy. There is so, so many stories and people out there who have been through something very similar. I'm literally like blown away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild how many people can relate. And even people will comment and say, I didn't grow up in a cult, but I had narcissistic parents, or I've been in narcissistic relationships. And everything that you're saying is almost identical to my experience. So there really is a need out there to step up and share your story. So I'm glad that you have been brave enough and courageous enough to do that, because clearly through your Instagram, people want to hear from you.
I guess so. That was a surprise to me too.
That's awesome. Well, that kind of brings us to our Linda Listen sassy statement, as the viral video with the toddler goes, to someone who's pissed you off, or something inspirational. Up to you.
I kind of went with something a little of both, to be honest.
Ooh, let's hear it.
Okay. Using your selfish desires to control others isn't bringing them closer to God. It brings them to shame and guilt. And a relationship with God isn't about that at all.
That is a little mix of both. I like it. Mm-hmm. Very, very powerful.
I feel like people need to know that God isn't that shame. And I think one of the biggest things that I've had to learn how to do is forgive myself.
Yeah. And it's hard, and it takes years, really. Like you said, the voices in our head will always pop up and be like, girl, be humble. And then I'm like, psh, screw you. Quiet.
Be like, I want to say. I'm going to say what I want to say.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, this has been so great. Thank you for coming on and sharing and being so vulnerable. Do you have any final thoughts before we go?
Not really. I feel like we covered a lot today.
We did. So. We did. Well, it was so great to hear more of your story. And guys, if you are still listening and watching, definitely leave some words of encouragement for Cece. Go check out Pink Valor and her Instagram. And if you want to support the podcast, you can get some of our merch. It's not as cool as Cece's, but it is pretty cool. We have some Apostates Unite shirts for our fellow apostates out there. And oh, I'm sorry for what I said when I was in a cult. Lots of fun stuff. You can find that at cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. And you could become a patron if you would like to support in that way. We have some tiers that are as low as $5 a month. And that would be great. You can find that at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. And if you like this video, I will link two more down here below that you can check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.